Hello and welcome to the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zach Elwood. This is a podcast about psychology and behavior. You can learn more about it at peoplewhoreadpeople.com. Sometimes this podcast focuses on America's political polarization problem because I think it's our most serious problem and also a problem that, by its nature, prevents people from caring much about solving the problem. I focus on it because I think not nearly enough people do. On today's episode, I talk to David Foster, who writes about polarization and the media landscape on his site, knowthesystem.org, and who recently released a book aimed at reducing toxic polarization titled Moderates of the World Unite, Reworking the Political Media Complex. David and I talk about polarization and the media, and we focus on the question, what's the most optimal strategy for trying to reduce toxic polarization? Is it better to focus on making systemic changes, like passing legislation aimed at improving the media environment or other policies? Or is it better to focus on changing the culture, changing the way everyday people think and treat each other? David is focused more on the systemic aspects, specifically with regards to the media environment. In my own work, I've focused on more cultural change types of things. So this talk might be interesting to you apart from political polarization, because the focus really is on how do we change culture for the better? What are the levers we have to pull, and which levers are the most effective? And for anyone interested in polarization, I think this is a very important question that doesn't get asked enough. Trying to figure out the best ways to spend our time is an important issue. We want to get the most bang for our buck or for our effort. So it's David and I's hope that this is of value for people in the bridge building and depolarization space. And just to note that this is a video talk and the video version is on my People Who Read People YouTube channel. So if you're listening on audio and it sounds less edited than usual, that's why. I've been trying to do more video talks. Okay, here's the talk with David Foster, author of Moderates of the World Unite. Yeah, let's start out with how did you get into this work? What drives your passion in this area? If you wanted to summarize that, I know that's a big question.
Yeah, well, I mean, the motivation is probably pretty similar to yours, and everyone who works in the whole problem of polarization and depolarization. I want to see this country have a more pragmatic problem-solving attitude towards everything. And, you know, and we have a polarization is kind of making our government, especially the Congress, kind of dysfunctional and unable to do much of anything, as, you know, as we are currently seeing in the Congress, you know, even in the past few weeks. And so that, you know, that's what's driving me. It's, I guess you could call it idealistic, but, you know, I'm really interested in, I think it's a super important problem, and it kind of gets in the way of solving other problems. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what's driving me. And I've had, my career has been in online course development, e-learning, and my educational background even goes back into that studying learning theory and cognitive science and computer science. And so, you know, that's, I know a lot about learning systems, like technology-based learning systems. And I think maybe that gave me ideas about ways to approach the problem that not everyone would think of. But, you know, I rose to a pretty high level, I guess, in that whole sector. But decided 5 years ago that I want to work on this problem because it's so urgent.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Is part of your frustration maybe like mine, where you feel like a bit of frustration because people aren't paying enough attention to these things as they should?
Yeah, huge frustration, and it's super daunting. I mean, you know, you and I have talked a lot, and I think we both feel it. You know, it's. I remember a guy who was kind of a mentor who was coaching me, and he described it once, you know, well, you know, David, what you're doing is sort of like standing on the yellow line in between two lanes of traffic speeding in different directions. You know, that's kind of where the moderates and the people who want to work on polarization are.
You need like a thin yellow line flag or something.
Yeah, definitely.
Maybe we could work on that branding. Yeah, that might be good.
No, there's a branding opportunity for sure.
Yeah, maybe that's a good segue to talk about, you know, you and I have talked about the two different high level categories of how to approach this kind of work. Like the, you know, you focused on the more systemic changes, like changes to media or policy. And I have focused more on like grassroots, like convincing people of the need for it. And yeah, and I want us to be real frank here, because I have my own, you know, I have my own doubts about whether I'm spending, you know, we can all like second guess if we're spending our time on the right things. But maybe you could talk a little bit about, you know, why you have focused on the systemic changes as opposed to, you know, the more kind of grassroots, mass mainstream convincing efforts.
Right, right. It's a really good question and quite a dilemma. You know, I have to caveat first by saying that I do see a lot of value in grassroots efforts, and I admire the work that people are doing, and it can only be a net positive. Even if it doesn't change the world, it every little bit helps. And I also, you know, the other caveat is we need multiple approaches. None of us knows which is going to have the most impact. And so, you know, we should welcome all approaches, as I do, and I'm sure you do as well. The analogy, you know, try out this analogy. I'm curious what you think. My belief is that there, you know, there's some value towards focusing on the system level things in terms of efficiency and productivity and impact. An analogy that I would use is when inflation is heating up, you know, one approach would be to try to convince all the companies in the country to not raise prices. Or the Fed can raise interest rates and, you know, and it spreads through the whole system and it's more efficient and scalable and all those good things. And so the analogy in the face of escalating polarization, you know, one approach is to try to convince individuals to, you know, work on their own contributions to polarization. And, you know, you'll get some people to do it for sure, and it helps. But my take on it is that why not instead go at the cause of it in the media environments? Mm-hmm. And, you know, what's really causing it, because, you know, it's my belief that the escalating polarization we've had in the last 20 years is not due to a change in human nature. That's kind of the reverse direction of causality, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. That, you know, when you're trying to fix individuals, that's trying to fix the effects, whereas, you know, in my opinion, the cause is primarily due to the change in the public media environment. Mm,
right, the environment, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or not public media, just the media environment.
Right, right. Yeah, and I'd say I'm with you in the sense that, you know, I don't have any firm opinions. Actually, talking to you about this in the past made me update my book, because I felt like I was downplaying systemic change too much. It's not that I'm like, I think systemic changes are very good and very important. It's more, and like you say, I think we need everybody working on it, because I think the way I think of what I'm doing, or what like other organizations who focus on convincing people of the need, I see it as like some of those people we convince that it's a big problem will help create the systemic changes, right? And there needs to be some sort of pressure to work on those things. But yeah, like you say, it's like I have doubts about what am I, or what are any of these organizations really doing? You know, they're because if you change a few people's minds, yeah, how much is it doing? But then, you know, you can also have those doubts about the systemic change aspect, where it's like, how can we really get this gridlocked Congress to like pass a systemic change? And, you know, so like to your point, it's like, I see them as like working in concert. You have to like convince enough people to even try it to whatever you're going to try to do systemically. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, it's a chicken and egg problem for sure. You know, I agree that that could, you know, if enough people are sort of working on depolarizing themselves and you know, and learning how to be more civil and so forth, that could generate some pressure, but it's not really getting them thinking about the media environment and about, you know, what's, and so if no one's really thinking about, well, what could Congress even do? You know, that's not going to put any pressure on Congress, or at least that's my concern.
Yeah. And to your point, I could imagine, you know, like somebody could easily take a Republican or a Democrat congressperson could easily take an idea out of your book and make a bill around it or something. Right. And like, theoretically, that could pretty easily get bipartisan support and could pass and you could make a big impact. So, I mean, I see your argument that it's like the effort of getting something through to draw attention or to change the media environment is like theoretically like a much bigger payoff for the effort, right? Because I have that sense too when I'm like, say, like, you know, say even a few thousand people read my book, for example, it's like, yeah, what does that really do? It's like, I think most of that effort is actually wasted, but it's like kind of my hope that a few of those people will do something else, you know, like a few of those people will be influential is kind of like my idea. That's how I think of it. It's like maybe one of those people, for example, could be a congressperson who takes one of your ideas and makes it into a bill, you know, it's like,
absolutely.
That's kind of absolutely. How I view the interconnection there. You know, it's like, I think, yeah, it's all good stuff. And yeah. And I'm not convinced my approach is like the most efficient or that, you know, so a quick note here. I wanted to say that I think I was underselling cultural change work a little bit here. I don't work on cultural change stuff only in the hopes that it gets people to work on more systemic changes. That's underselling what I see as the power and goals there. I think it's actually easier to change culture than we sometimes think. Sometimes all it can take is a few relatively influential people pushing back on certain behaviors to affect other people's behaviors, to affect a lot of people's behaviors. I think many of us have overly pessimistic and fatalistic views about the difficulty of changing culture. I think getting a decent percentage of people to think differently about politics and how we engage with other people can actually make a big difference, especially if some of those people have influential voices and are brave enough to speak up and push back on the incentives and the toxic polarization. I just wanted to clarify that a little bit as I felt I was doing a disservice to the cultural change work. Okay, back to the talk.
Well, I'm probably jumping ahead and, you know, talking about the specific ideas, but you said something about it would be easy enough for a legislator to take one of the ideas in my book and turn it into a bill. I don't necessarily think that's the case. I don't think it'd be that easy.
Oh, not that easy. It's possible, yeah. Though, right? I
mean, but it's possible, yeah. And you know, unless people are sort of suggesting it, then it won't happen at all. But and you know, we can get into this if you want. But part of the problem is especially on the right, who just doesn't want a lot of people on the right who just don't want the government to do anything. You know, you can make your arguments about how, wait, this is fair to both sides, you know, what we're doing here. But yeah, there will be resistance.
To that point, that was actually like, it's kind of obvious in hindsight, but that didn't really strike me until pretty recently, a few months ago, where I saw a conservative person on Twitter respond to an idea of a government-led, you know, depolarization effort. They were, like you said, they were very much against the idea for the usual conservative reasons of like, we don't want government solving this. Government's just going to make it worse, or, you know.
Right.
So that I hadn't really realized that. But in hindsight, it's like, yeah, of course, they'd be against a government solution. That's not to say all conservatives, all Republicans would be against that, because, you know, clearly Republicans have some government programs they like. So if you could convince enough of them, then, you know, maybe it'd go over well. But yeah, that was an interesting angle too, that I hadn't really seen until recently.
Yeah, no, definitely. That's one of many
obstacles.
obstacles and barriers. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or headwinds, or I don't know what the right metaphor is.
Yeah. I think the difficult thing, you know, with the gridlock and the, you know, always thinking in the worst case framing is like, even if you arrived at something that in better times, both sides would agree to mostly, it's like, you can, how it often goes is like, one side will be like, I think they're getting a slight advantage. So they, you know, are against it, you know, so that kind of how a lot of these things end up going, which is, you know, speaks to the problem of polarization in general. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, this is another one of these things where a large portion of the country is pretty tired and disgusted with, you know, the extreme partisanship and the gridlock. And, you know, I mean, even you could even maybe say that a lot of Trump's base is motivated by just, you know, the antipathy towards Congress, and, you know, how they just aren't, you know, paying attention to what they care about, or what their needs are. Or, and so, you know, and then there's the, you know, the exhausted majority kind of stuff, you know? So I think there's a hunger for it, but it needs to get more focused. And that's, I think, one of the things I hope my book might be, you know, in a small way, helpful in trying to do.
I do think there's, even in Congress, I think there's, even if they don't, there's like pressure to not talk about it. I think even many of those people want solutions, right? Because they don't, I think many of them, even if they stay quiet for fear out of hurting their side or whatever, I think many of them are sick of it, you know? And
oh, for sure. Yeah. Well, you know, like there's the Problem Solvers Caucus, which is, you know, that's kind of their mission, is to sort of bust through all that. But it hasn't been easy. And and no labels, you know, this it's been excoriated by Democrats because it's a spoiler. It's going to get Trump into office, you know, and so forth. But in spite of all that, I think they have, you know, they have some base of support that's, you know, wants to look for a different way.
That's good to have. Yeah, it's like a trial balloon to see how, you know, how much support those kind of third party candidates would get.
Totally.
Do you want to talk about the, let's talk about your book. If you want to talk about, you know, what were you most proud of when it comes to the proposals in there, or what was the most unique ideas? Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, no, definitely. Well, I haven't even said much about the book. So just kind of high level to start. The book has two parts to it. One is, it's kind of an analysis of the way that for-profit media in the last 2 to 3 decades has influenced and caused a really rapidly accelerating polarization in the country. And then the second half is I attempt to provide a vision of several national level initiatives, you know, at a scale that it tries to match the size of the problem, as a way to potentially turn things around. And so I can talk a little bit about some of the ideas, but the key theme, I guess, would be that it's trying to change the national speech environment. And, you know, and I think it's going to require, not for every one of the proposals, but for a lot of them, you know, some legislative action to make them happen. And, you know, that will bring out the free speech or First Amendment absolutists saying, you know, you can't do that. But a key is that none of the proposals are about any type of censorship or trying to control the content. And all of the proposals have to, you know, be nonpartisan and have the right governance structures in them and so on. And the goal is not to change the content of speech anywhere, but the speech environment. The world has changed pretty dramatically in the last 2 decades. You know, the speech environment, it's nothing like, you know, anything the founders could have ever envisioned. And so, and what we've seen is social media is destroying the economic model for journalism. You know, it's just become this terrible race for profitability, both the social media companies and the, you know, news media companies. It's Have you heard the expression cheap speech, which was coined a few years ago? It's it just kind of an acknowledgement that, you know, in the old days, there wasn't very many ways to get speech out there. You know, there was a few networks and so on. And in the new environments, you know, with lots of different TV channels and, of course, with social media and blogs, you know, we're just drowned in speech. And the founders could have never anticipated that. And so, you know, I believe that the Fourth Estate is supposed to facilitate democratic discourse. And I think what we're looking at is a massive market failure. And that's why I think who else but the government can come in and try to fix the speech environment. The speech environment, not speech.
Right. The environment. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is something I think about sometimes. I'm curious if you've thought a bit about it. I sometimes think about the immense demand for content that all these companies have and how that's a factor in destabilizing us. Like, it's like, in order to fill these airwaves, this vacuum of airwaves, people need content. And like, what are we going to make for content? We're going to make stuff that presses people's emotional buttons, right? So it's like, in order for the demand to create all this, you know, to make money basically and fill these, you know, this huge amount of bandwidth we have of content is like, and then they create all this stuff that polarizes us and divides us unintentionally often. But I just see it as kind of like this machine for destabilizing us. You know, it's like, yeah, there's just so many narratives floating around, so many divisive, polarizing narratives, and just so much content.
Well, you know, I think, you know, in this new era, we should start regarding the really limited amount of attention that individuals have as kind of a precious societal resource that we should stop wasting on sensationalism and you know, polarizing rhetoric and stuff like that. It's a really precious resource that we should be trying harder to make the best use of for everyone.
Right. Just think about the millions of hours that people spend on these meaningless shows and watching videos on TikTok. Anyway, I'm digressing and ranting a little bit, but it's just, I do that a good amount myself, but, maybe we can talk about your, one of your ideas that you're most proud of. I think you had mentioned something about the, can't remember the exact name, but something involving a silo.
Yeah. Yeah. That might be the one I'm proud of at some level, at least. I think it's kind of creative. So yeah, that one is, you know, in the modern media environment, we have these echo chambers, as they're called. You know, maybe it's sometimes overstated, but and when you're in an echo chamber, you only hear the version of reality, you know, on that political side, and what you do hear about the other side is mostly straw men. You know, it's like
worst case arguments.
Yes. Yeah, worst case arguments. And and you know, and when you're in echo chambers, it also can tend to push everyone to have more extreme views. Anyway, so the idea for this proposal is to pass a new law that requires all media outlets of all types, and this is never been easy for me to explain real quickly, but I'll do my best. Requires all of them to allow a new technical scheme that injects counter speech, on the spot counter speech, into every broadcast or article or whatever. And the way that would be done is to register what I call a designated opposition person for each of those news outlets, or I don't know how granular it would get, but, and so, and there'd be on all screens, whether it's a TV screen, computer screen, for social media or for a news website, associated with each content piece, there would be this recognizable button, which I call OPPO, O-P-P-O, for opposition. No one is ever encouraged or required to click on it, but anytime they do, they can get what an opposition person would have to say about that particular content. So can you see how it kind of, busts open the echo chamber in a way, by inserting. Now, you might think that, okay, that opposition person is just going to like spew propaganda and take apart everything that, the speaker or writer has to say. And it actually, I don't think would work that way because you're in a unfriendly audience and it's your job to.
You want to be persuasive.
Appeal to them.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't want to drive them away.
You don't want to drive them away. Yeah.
To win them over. Yeah.
Right.
That,
so I don't know. Is that a good explanation?
Yeah. I think people would have a lot of questions about how the specifics of
absolutely
how like
so buy yeah, the book and you'll
but yeah
you'll find
yeah
out.
Okay but yeah but that idea I mean it kind of gets to the heart of how I view these things because to me it's like this divergence of narratives right like these narratives are growing apart
oh yeah
so it's like anything you can do to get people to start considering the better aspects of the other narrative will draw the narratives a little bit closer together, right?
Yes.
So that's how I think about a lot of the stuff I write about. It's like if you engage with the better arguments on the other side, it draws the narratives together. I was going to bring up too a good example of the whole bubble phenomenon recently was when the Supreme Court was, everybody knew the Supreme Court was going to weigh in on the Colorado ruling to remove Trump from the ballot. And that was a good example where in the liberal leaning, sphere, I saw these people act as if it was, a certainty that was a good ruling Colorado made. And like the only reason the Supreme Court would vote against it would be like conservative bias or pro-Trump bias. I read Tankle News, which I just interviewed Isaac Saul, who started Tankle News recently. And I had a much better idea that like, oh, from reading that and reading the arguments, I was almost certain that the Supreme Court was going to rule against it and why and what the good reasons were. Right. But the thing I saw in the liberal leaning sphere, including people I knew, it was like they spoke as if you had that opinion that was going to happen, or if you thought that was a good, those were good arguments that you were pro Trump or you had conservative bias. And I think that was just a good example where everyone was kind of shocked. Like, what do you mean that was a unanimous Supreme Court ruling? I was expecting it to be split amongst the usual, and that was just a good example where if your example for your solution for that would be, on CNN, there would have been somebody, explaining the better arguments and even why like liberals, Democrats should want that because, if it went the other way, it could be used against a Democrat president and these kind of better arguments, which I just don't think, many people are exposed to for many of these issues on either side.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, no, I we've talked about this before. We both believe that most political thinking is in the form of narratives, and a term I use a lot in my book for it is talking points, which are the sort of manifestations in public discourse that sort of create and activate and reinforce narratives.
Pieces of the narrative. Yeah, they're like
yes,
yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Gotcha.
I also, I don't know if this is the ideal place to stick this in, but since you brought up, the liberal bubble, I just wanted to plug your book. I think it's so great that the approach you're taking of, just focusing on one side for this book anyway, the
latest one. Yeah.
Your new one. Right. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Liberal, to a liberal anti-Trump audience. Yeah.
Right. Right. Yeah. Right. Because, there's so many liberals and progressive who think, oh, it's just that side's problem. And they don't see the way they're contributing to polarization themselves. And the way that liberal sanctimony just really pisses people on the right off to such a deep, deep degree.
The righteousness.
So and righteousness. Yeah.
Yeah. It's,
you know, not that there's not some of that going the other way too, but it's not totally it's not totally symmetric in my opinion.
Well, I do. Yeah. I do often think about the, I mean, there's all sorts of asymmetries, which I think is an unexamined part of examining American polarization or any conflict is these group asymmetries. It's like,
yeah,
the fact that, you know, liberal leaning people dominate the, you know, mainstream media and the, you know, Hollywood and, you know, academic world. It's like, that is an asymmetry that has effects on how the conflict plays out. And I don't think those kind of asymmetries are talked about enough, but,
right.
Yeah.
Right.
About your, I was going to ask you about your book title, you know, the word moderates can be kind of like off-putting to some people because some people are like, I have, you know, views that some people would consider extreme. Like, I don't want to be a moderate, you know, so, but there's different approaches of explaining or defining what a moderate is. So maybe you could talk a little bit about how you view that word.
Sure. Yeah. The definition. Yeah. No, there's a lot of different interpretations and some of the interpretations of what a moderate is aren't too complimentary. You know, they're people who are wishy-washy, indecisive, low information. And, you know, and that's true for some people for sure. But so the definition I used in my book, and it's not a standard definition, but it's people who despise both the hard right and the hard left, mm-hmm. you know, who are resistant to sort of one-sided, grand sweeping narratives that come from either side. And so...
And when you say despise, you don't have to hate them as people, just really dislike their ideas and approach, right?
Yeah, well... Yes, except for I have a special place in hell in my book for propagandists who intentionally manipulate the system. You know, I most of what's going on in the system is just economic forces, you know, and like I don't blame journalists or social media companies or anyone generally. The one category of bad actors, though, is propagandists. So. But, you know,
you got your 9 levels of polarization hell.
Exactly. But to your larger point, no, I never.
Yeah. Yeah. I was just clarifying.
Despise. Yeah. Yeah. The people who are in a lot of cases pawns of a lot of this. But yeah.
Although I will say like the thing that strikes me is like some of these people who I think are some of the most, in my mind, honestly, kind of gross and despicable people. I'm not going to name any names right now. I talk about them elsewhere, but some of these people are to me, like, it's really hard to separate their, you know, their propaganda from like the true belief, because some of these people just to me are like, their minds have been deranged by conflict, right? They're kind of like, they really do think that they're in an us versus them battle. And like, I guess that gets into where they're willing to, the ends justify the means kind of approaches, where they're like, yeah, we're willing to, you know, bend the truth or even lie because the ends are so justified. And
not to
excuse it, but it kind of like some of these people, I think, have been deranged by conflict, which I think is kind of like the bad thing about conflict and extreme polarization is it deranges more and more people to be that way, right?
Sure, definitely. Yeah, no, and yeah, no, and if I thought the planet was going to be destroyed if I didn't win, I might be willing to lie too, you know. So I your point is well taken, but I will name one name just as kind of a counter example.
And I'm willing to name some names, you know, I just didn't want to derail it, but
oh, well, I'll just name one. And although I won't go so far as to say that I know what his true beliefs are, but Christopher Rufo, do you remember that ignominious tweet that he did, I don't know, about 3 years ago about how he was programming the world to understand the words critical race theory in a specific way?
Yeah, he was basically like lifting up the curtain and saying,
lifting up the curtain.
Here's my approach to ruining this word and making it toxic in like kind of in a manipulative, deceptive way, right?
Yeah, yeah. No, he didn't even, there was no hint of apology or, you know, or any sort of self, or any kind of justification. It just, it painted a picture of, you know, that he regards conservatives as rubes, that, you know, the general public on the conservative side is so manipulable, and that I can program their thinking and they won't be any of the wiser, you know. I just find that so reprehensible.
It's a strange thing too, because like there's plenty of, you know, disagree or not, there's plenty of ways to, you know, denigrate those CRT ideas or whatever ideas on the left.
Sure.
Like there's plenty of like, you don't have to do that to demean someone else's ideas, right? There's plenty of legitimate ways that you can disagree. So yeah, I'm pretty sure I mentioned his book about like the Marxist ideology on the left in my recent book as an example of like, I might have taken it out because it's more for a liberal audience now, but an example of how both sides in conflict will reach for these really elaborate, extra pessimistic narratives that go back in history and help build up this narrative of the immense badness and scariness of the other side. Like he'll, you know, so tying it to, you know, and there is some truth through it, right? Like far left ideas do appear, you know, in these dangerous scenarios, and there's been all sorts of bad things and the horrors of, communism and stuff in some of these countries. But it's like to build this narrative, which is what the left does about the how everything on the right is linking back to this racism and this elaborate narrative, right?
Sure.
Not to say it's the same. We all have our views about who's doing it more than the others and who's doing it worse, but there's just this tendency to build these elaborate narratives, which is what I see Rufo and these other people doing, is like, and whether he believes it or not, to your point, it's like he could be doing it purposely as a means to, you know, just destroy the brand. Not that it, you know, really needs it, because there's plenty of other people doing it too. But he could be doing it, yeah, painting that picture purposefully, or he could really believe, like, that's the scariness that he sees on the left. And it can be hard to say. But to your point, yeah, his tweet about kind of saying, here's my strategy for painting these things really negatively, kind of shows you where his mind's at. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I could say more about it, because I do have a section of my book that kind of drills in, kind of like you did in your first book, you know, drills into specific topics and sort of explores the talking points on each side and how quickly they fall apart if you just look at them, you know, briefly. But I talk a bit about Rufo and critical race theory, and you know, he has this briefing book that he puts together for use by, I don't know, in schools or parents or what have you. And you just look at it and it's like straw man, one after the other, you know. It's so transparent. And you know, and this thing about, I think we're going afield a little bit, but that critical race theory is Marxist. Who cares? Why should I care about that? You know? But, you know, Marxism is a scare word, you know, and it's, right. All right.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah. There's all sorts of, it's quite easy. That's the thing. Getting back to the narrative idea, it's like,
yeah,
the importance of stories, like, it's so easy to build. I think that's a really key fundamental aspect of understanding polarization too. It's just so easy to build stories, right? It's like humans we can build stories out of nothing, basically. So it's like you give us a few, like a two or three data points, we can build this story around it, right? Like tying all this stuff together, or, you know, the story about the threat you're facing or how bad your enemies are, right? It's like,
yeah.
There's just,
yeah,
it's just so easy for us.
Oh, it's easy to do. Yeah. No, I mentioned in my book, Daniel Kahneman talks about what he calls the illusion of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
It, you know, the principle is that we just latch onto these stories and the world isn't really as explainable as it seems to be. And in fact, the less you know, the more certain you can feel about, you know, that your story is a reflection of reality.
Yeah. I just want to throw in there was, I've been reading this philosopher, Kevin Durst's work. He's got a Substack, and he talks about basically like rational polarization, how we can, you know, have these both sides on any issue can have these rational narratives and they were reached rationally and be completely divergent. And it's all about how you sample information in a complex system, because you can't absorb all the information. You just pick and choose. That's not to say everybody's, you know, clearly there's a lot of irrationality, but he's talking about, you know, a lot of these issues that we argue over, there's various rational narratives you could put together, but then you add on top the toxic polarization, which makes us veer towards the irrational for how we, you know, for some of these things. But I think he's talking about a pretty important key part of it, where it's like the fundamental ways that we can rationally diverge on a lot of these complex issues.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I, you know, that's one thing I, you know, deep in my soul, I look around and I think, where's the intellectual humility? You know, I'd love to teach people about how little they know and how much they shouldn't rely on what they think they know. But, you know, that's a tough one. I got a lot of that out of studying cognitive science and the way that people make inferences and you know, the sort of the values that are hidden underneath a lot of it and so on and so forth. You know, there's been a lot of great researchers and scholars who've written about it. But
we need like a PBS show or some kind of public service show every day reminding people that they're idiots, you know. It's like it's like that'd be
you are so dumb.
Yeah, it's like I'm an idiot. We're all idiots, and let's just walk through how badly we get stuff wrong. That would actually be a pretty good show.
Yeah, I'd watch it.
Somebody's probably done something like that.
Probably.
do you want to talk anything about anything that you feel that we really miss that is important about your work that you want to throw in?
Well, thank you for asking. I just kind of to pull in stuff we were talking at the very beginning. So, you know, this Bust Open the Silos national initiative that I described earlier, you know, that's one of seven that I have in the book. Kind of the theme is finding ways to help people learn about politics and about political argumentation, but not through like anything formal, just, you know, in daily life through ways that don't require any effort or willpower or study. You know, that's kind of a theme through several of my proposals. But like I said, some of them would definitely require legislative action, which is pretty tough. And so I just wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, so I don't think we can go straight to any of these proposals. And you know, the route that I have in mind, and it's partly why I named the book the way I did. I don't know, the
name. Moderates of the World Unite.
Yes, yes.
Mention that again.
There could be, thank you. There could be pros and cons to that title, but a serious part of it is that, you know, I think for any of this to happen, it's going to require a critical mass of engaged moderates to stand up and start demanding change of Congress. And so, you know, where my focus is going to be next is to work on ways to create educational materials that even include describing these proposals to people so that they can start to get a vision, you know, not only that, oh, there's ways we could improve it, but also to get a better sense that, gosh, how did we get into this? You know, this is not how the Fourth Estate is supposed to work in theory, even, you know. And so my hope is that through creating educational materials like for college level and even for public spaces, you know, I can play some small role in starting to help develop that critical mass of engaged moderates. You know, that, you know, will lead to greater amounts of advocacy and you know, kind of as a complement to the grassroots depolarization efforts that you and others are working on. So,
and eventually you can create a moderate militia of moderate to start the kickoff.
Go ahead, make fun of me.
The moderate revolution. No, you said it. You said your book title was supposed to be a little funny, right? Like
that, it is. Yeah,
moderate, it's like moderates revolting. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, workers of the world unite. Right?
Yeah. Okay. I just wanted to clarify. I wasn't mocking it. So, did you also want to mention? Because I really liked your idea about the responses to, you know, specifically polarizing tweets or other posts. Did you want to mention that idea really briefly?
Oh, sure.
In case anyone watching it might, you know, theoretically someone watching it might, you know, want to contact you about the idea or something.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, that's one issue I've started prototyping. And it's one of the seven proposals in the book is, I'm calling it right now, at least the school marm. The vision is to have a large nonpartisan organization that the focus, just to back up a little, is on polarizing rhetoric on social media, of which there's a lot, of course.
A little bit.
Not so much about like factual falsehoods and of course nothing, you know, not like the sort of illegal stuff which the platforms themselves are responsible for taking care of and, you know, taking down. But, you know, the platforms have no incentive to sort of do anything about polarized rhetoric on their platforms and certainly no business interest in doing so. So, but an external organization could go in and selectively go in and find polarizing posts. And when it does, attaching a little bit of educational material right next to those posts. And it, of course, it's not going to get everyone. But, you know, if you get enough of them that people start seeing this once in a while, even, it'll raise consciousness. And people will, you know, when they see polarizing rhetoric, you know, they'll sort of slow down a little bit. And maybe some of them, some users will try to temper what they say online a little better, and it'll just kind of reduce the status of like dunking and so that's the school marm.
Yeah, I like that. I do think, yeah, I getting back to the idea that there is a real demand out there for reducing these kind of like team-based ways of thinking and high contempt ways of engaging, I do think you'd see people respond to that. I mean, that was one of the, you know, I kind of took a similar small scale approach with my Twitter. That was basically what I was doing, was just responding and doing a little bit of that. But I do think there's a hunger there for it. And I think a lot of times people just don't even know like what that path looks like. So they're like looking for like, oh, that's how this works. Like, that's how we do it. Like, because I think a lot of people want that, but they just don't even know, you know, how do we get better? You know, what is better discourse look like, or what do we have to push against exactly, you know, because it's
right.
Yeah. So I think that would be, I'm a fan of that. Yeah. The more people, even just people listening who want to do that on their own, I think that's a like creating, you know, encouraging people to be like, hey, go examine why this person's speech is unreasonable and polarizing. And, you know, not in an insulting way, but a persuasive way to say like, hey, can you see how this leads to, you know, the toxicity and such. Yeah.
Right. Well, and you know, just to pile on that, you know, Christopher Bale at Duke, who's studied this a lot, has measured, you know, that the more extreme people on social media are the ones that post by far the most and get promoted the most. And moderates just, you know, they don't even speak up. Mm-hmm. You know, it's too intimidating. They're going to get and so people don't even see moderates. Well, not none, but you know, there's not that much in the political realm. There's not that much moderate speech right now. And if there were ways to encourage them to feel comfortable to speak, mm-hmm. and just bring the temperature down on social media.
Right,
you know?
Right. That's the thing. Yeah. I mean, it really does work. I mean, I've seen just in my personal life on Facebook with a few friends, it's like somebody shares something kind of unreasonable and everyone's like, yeah. And then you make a point about poking a hole in the logic gently and everyone's like, oh yeah, you're right. That's, you know, it's a good point.
Yeah.
Tone down the frame, you know? Yeah. So it's like, it doesn't actually take that much, but to your point, it's like so few people feel like getting into those, you know, kind of like caustic interactions and they, you know, it's just not, it takes effort. It takes time. It takes a headache. You risk offending people, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So there's all these reasons, but,
right. Yeah. Right.
Okay. Yeah. This has been great. David, I appreciate it. And, best of luck, getting the book out there.
Thanks so much.
That was a talk with David Foster. You can learn more about him at his site, knowthesystem.org. I'll include links to some of the things we talked about, including his book, at the entry for this episode on my site, peoplewhoreadpeople.com. And you can learn more about my soon-to-be-released new book on polarization at american-anger.com. Thanks for listening. Music by Small Skies.